I took up the two packages and gave the bread to the little girl, the woman all iron-gray behind the counter, watching us with cold certitude. "You wait a minute," she said. She went to the rear. The door opened again and closed. The little girl watched me, holding the bread against her dirty dress. "What's your name?" I said. She quit looking at me, but she was still motionless. She didn't even seem to breathe. The woman returned. She had a funny-looking thing in her hand. She carried it sort of like it might have been a dead pet rat. "Here," she said. The child looked at her. "Take it," the woman said, jabbing it at the little girl. "It just looks peculiar. I calculate you won't know the difference when you eat it. Here, I can't stand here all day." The child took it, still watching her. The woman rubbed her hands on her apron. "I got to have that bell fixed," she said. She went to the door and jerked it open. The little bell tinkled once, faint and clear and invisible. We moved toward the door and the woman's peering back. "Thank you for the cake," I said. "Them foreigners," she said, staring up into the obscurity where the bell tinkled. "Take my advice and stay clear of them, young man." "Yes'm," I said. "Come on, sister." We went out. "Thank you, ma'am." She swung the door to, then jerked it open again, making the bell give forth its single small note. "Foreigners," she said, peering up at the bell. We went on. "Well," I said, "how about some ice cream?" She was eating the gnarled cake. "Do you like ice cream?" She gave me a black still look, chewing. "Come on." We came to the drug store and had some ice cream. She wouldn't put the loaf down. "Why not put it down so you can eat better?" I said, offering to take it. But she held to it, chewing the ice cream like it was taffy. The bitten cake lay on the table. She ate the ice cream steadily, then she fell to on the cake again, looking about at the showcases. I finished mine, and we went out. "Which way do you live?" I said. "A buggy, the one with the white horse it was. Only Doc Peabody is fat, 300 pounds. You ride with him on the uphill side, holding on. Children, walking easier than holding uphill." "Seen the doctor yet? Have you seen Caddy?" "I don't have to. I can't ask now. Afterward, it will be all right. It won't matter." "Because women so delicate, so mysterious," Father said. "Delicate equilibrium of periodical filth between two moons balanced. Moons," he said, "full and yellow as harvest moons, her hips, thighs, outside, outside of them always, but yellow, feet, soles with walking like. Then know that some man, that all those mysterious and imperious concealed, with all that inside of them shapes an outward suavity waiting for a touch to, liquid putrefaction like drowned things floating like pale rubber flabbily filled, getting the odor of honeysuckle all mixed up." "You'd better take your bread on home, hadn't you?" She looked at me. She chewed quietly and steadily. At regular intervals, a small distension passed smoothly down her throat. I opened my package and gave her one of the buns. "Goodbye," I said. I went on. Then I looked back. She was behind me. "Do you live down this way?" She said nothing. She walked beside me, under my elbow, sort of, eating. We went on. It was quiet, hardly anyone about. Getting the odor of honeysuckle all mixed, she would have told me not to let me sit there on the steps, hearing her door, twilight slamming, hearing Benji still crying. Supper, she would have to come down then, getting honeysuckle all mixed up in it. We reached the corner. "Well, I've got to go down this way," I said. "Goodbye." She stopped, too. She swallowed the last of the cake. Then she began on the bun, watching me across it. "Goodbye," I said. I turned into the street and went on, but I went to the next corner before I stopped. "Which way do you live?" I said. "This way?" I pointed down the street. She just looked at me. "Do you live over that way? I bet you live close to the station where the trains are, don't you?" She just looked at me, serene and secret and chewing. The street was empty both ways, with quiet lawns and houses neat among the trees, but no one at all except back there. We turned and went back. Two men sat in chairs in front of a store. Do you all know this little girl? She sort of took up with me, and I can't find where she lives. They quit looking at me and looked at her. Must be one of them new Italian families, one said. He wore a rusty frock coat. I've seen her before. What's your name, little girl? She looked at them blackly for a while, her jaws moving steadily. She swallowed without ceasing to chew. Maybe she can't speak English, the other said. They sent her after bread, I said. She must be able to speak something. What's your pa's name? The first said. Pete? Joe? Name John, huh? She took another bite from the bun. What must I do with her? I said. She just follows me. I've got to get back to Boston. You from the college? Yes, sir, and I've got to get on back. You might go up the street and turn her over to Answer. He'll be up at the livery stable, the marshal. I reckon that's what I'll have to do, I said. I've got to do something with her. Much obliged. Come on, sister. We went up the street on the shady side, where the shadow of the broken facade blotted slowly across the road. We came to the livery stable. The marshal wasn't there. A man sitting in a chair tilted in the broad low door, where a dark cool breeze smelling of ammonia blew among the ranked stalls, said to look at the post office. He didn't know her either. Them foreigners, I can't tell one from another. You might take her across the tracks where they live, and maybe somebody'll claim her. We went to the post office. It was back down the street. The man in the frock coat was opening a newspaper. Answer just drove out of town, he said. I guess you'd better go down past the station and walk past them houses by the river. Somebody there'll know her. I guess I'll have to, I said. Come on, sister. She pushed the last piece of the bun into her mouth and swallowed it. Want another? I said. She looked at me, chewing, her eyes black and unwinking and friendly. I took the other two buns out and gave her one and bit into the other. I asked a man where the station was, and he showed me. Come on, sister. We reached the station and crossed the tracks where the river was. A bridge crossed it, and a street of jumbled frame houses followed the river, backed onto it. A shabby street, but with an air heterogeneous and vivid, too. In the center of an untrimmed plot enclosed by a fence of gaping and broken pickets stood an ancient lopsided surrey and a weathered house from an upper window of which hung a garment of vivid pink. "Does that look like your house?" I said. She looked at me over the bun. "This one?" I said, pointing. She just chewed, but it seemed to me that I discerned something affirmative, acquiescent even if it wasn't eager, in her air. "This one?" I said. "Come on, then." I entered the broken gate. I looked back at her. "Here?" I said. "This look like your house?" She nodded her head rapidly, looking at me, gnawing into the damp half-moon of the bread. We went on. A walk of broken random flags, speared by fresh coarse blades of grass, led to the broken stoop. There was no movement about the house at all, and the pink garment hanging in no wind from the upper window. There was a bell pull with a porcelain knob attached to about 6 feet of wire when I stopped pulling and knocked. The little girl had the crust edgeways in her chewing mouth. A woman opened the door. She looked at me, then she spoke rapidly to the little girl in Italian, with a rising inflection, then a pause, interrogatory. She spoke to her again, the little girl looking at her across the end of the crust, pushing it into her mouth with a dirty hand. "She says she lives here," I said. "I met her downtown. Is this your bread?" "No speaker," the woman said. She spoke to the little girl again. The little girl just looked at her. "No live here," I said. I pointed to the girl, then at her, then at the door. The woman shook her head. She spoke rapidly. She came to the edge of the porch and pointed down the road, speaking. I nodded violently, too. "You come show?" I said. I took her arm, waving my other hand toward the road. She spoke swiftly, pointing. "You come show," I said, trying to lead her down the steps. "See, see," she said, holding back, showing me whatever it was. I nodded again. "Thanks, thanks, thanks." I went down the steps and walked toward the gate, not running, but pretty fast. I reached the gate and stopped and looked at her for a while. The crust was gone now, and she looked at me with her black friendly stare. The woman stood on the stoop, watching us. "Come on, then," I said. We'll have to find the right one sooner or later. She moved along just under my elbow. We went on. The houses all seemed empty, not a soul in sight. A sort of breathlessness that empty houses have. Yet they couldn't all be empty. All the different rooms, if you could just slice the walls away all of a sudden. Madam, your daughter, if you please. No, madam, for God's sake, your daughter. She moved along just under my elbow, her shiny tight pigtails. And then the last house played out and the road curved out of sight beyond a wall, following the river. The woman was emerging from the broken gate with a shawl over her head and clutched under her chin. The road curved on, empty. I found a coin and gave it to the little girl, a quarter. Goodbye, sister, I said. Then I ran. I ran fast, not looking back. Just before the road curved away, I looked back. She stood in the road, a small figure clasping the loaf of bread to her filthy little dress, her eyes still and black and unwinking. I ran on. A lane turned from the road. I entered it, and after a while I slowed to a fast walk. The lane went between back premises, unpainted houses with more of those gay and startling colored garments on lines, a barn broken-backed, decaying quietly among rank orchard trees, unpruned and weed-choked, pink and white and murmurous with sunlight and with bees. I looked back. The entrance to the lane was empty. I slowed still more, my shadow pacing me, dragging its head through the weeds that hid the fence. The lane went back to a barred gate, became defunctive in grass, a mere path scarred quietly into new grass. I climbed the gate into a woodlot and crossed it, and came to another wall and followed that one, my shadow behind me now. There were vines and creepers where at home would be honeysuckle. Coming and coming especially in the dusk when it rained, getting honeysuckle all mixed up in it as though it were not enough without that, not unbearable enough. What did you let him for? Kiss, kiss. I didn't let him, I made him. Watching me getting mad. What do you think of that? Red print of my hand coming up through her face like turning a light on, under your hand, her eyes going bright. It's not for kissing I slapped you. Girl's elbows at 15. Father said, you swallow like you had a fishbone in your throat. What's the matter with you? And Caddy across the table not to look at me. It's for letting it be some darn town squirt I slapped you. You will you? Now I guess you say calf rope. My hand coming up out of her face. What do you think of that? Scouring her head into the... Grass sticks crisscrossed into the flesh, tingling, scouring her head. Say calf rope, say it. I didn't kiss a dirty girl like Natalie anyway. The wall went into shadow, and then my shadow. I had tricked it again. I had forgot about the river curving along the road. I climbed the wall. And then she watched me jump down, holding the loaf against her dress. I stood in the weeds and we looked at one another for a while. Why didn't you tell me you lived out this way, sister? The loaf was wearing slowly out of the paper. Already it needed a new one. Well, come on then and show me the house. Not a dirty girl like Natalie. It was raining, we could hear it on the roof, sighing through the high, sweet emptiness of the barn. There? Touching her. Not there. There? Not raining hard, but we couldn't hear anything but the roof, and if it was my blood or her blood. She pushed me down the ladder and ran off and left me, Caddy did. Was it there it hurt you when Caddy did? Ran off, was it there? Oh. She walked just under my elbow, the top of her patent leather head, the loaf fraying out of the newspaper. If you don't get home pretty soon, you're going to wear that loaf out, and then what'll your mama say? I bet I can lift you up. You can't, I'm too heavy. Did Caddy go away? Did she go to the house? You can't see the barn from our house. Did you ever try to see the barn from... It was her fault. She pushed me. She ran away. I can lift you up. See how I can... Oh, her blood or my blood. Oh. We went on in the thin dust, our feet silent as rubber in the thin dust where pencils of sun slanted in the trees. And I could feel water again running swift and peaceful in the secret shade. You live a long way, don't you? You're mighty smart to go this far to town by yourself. It's like dancing sitting down. Did you ever dance sitting down? We could hear the rain, a rat in the crib, the empty barn vacant with horses. How do you hold to dance? Do you hold like this? Oh, I used to hold like this. You thought I wasn't strong enough, didn't you? Oh, 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 oh. I hold to use like this. I mean, did you hear what I said? I said, I said. Oh, 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 oh. The road went on, still and empty, the sun slanting more and more. Her stiff little pigtails were bound at the tips with bits of crimson cloth. A corner of the wrapping flapped a little as she walked, the nose of the loaf naked. I stopped. "Look here, do you live down this road? We haven't passed a house in a mile, almost." She looked at me, black and secret and friendly. "Where do you live, sister? Don't you live back there in town?" There was a bird somewhere in the woods, beyond the broken and infrequent slanting of sunlight. "Your papa's going to be worried about you. Don't you reckon you'll get a whippin' for not coming straight home with that bread?" The bird whistled again, invisible, a sound meaningless and profound, inflectionless, ceasing as though cut off with the blow of a knife, and again, and that sense of water swift and peaceful above secret places, felt, not seen, not heard. "Oh, hell, sister." About half the paper hung limp. "That's not doing any good now." I tore it off and dropped it beside the road. "Come on, we'll have to go back to town. We'll go back along the river." We left the road. Among the moss, little pale flowers grew, and the sense of water mute and unseen.
This book is continued on Disc 4.
"Oh, hell, sister." About half the paper hung limp. "That's not doing any good now." I tore it off and dropped it beside the road. "Come on, we'll have to go back to town. We'll go back along the river." We left the road. Among the moss, little pale flowers grew, and the sense of water mute and unseen. "I hold to use like this. I mean, I used to hold..." She stood in the door looking at us, her hands on her hips. "You pushed me. It was your fault. It hurt me, too. We were dancing sitting down. I bet Caddy can't dance sitting down. Stop that. Stop that. I was just brushing the trash off the back of your dress. You keep your nasty old hands off of me. It was your fault. You pushed me down. I'm mad at you." "I don't care." She looked at us. "Stay mad." She went away. We began to hear the shouts, the splashings. I saw a brown body gleam for an instant. "Stay mad." My shirt was getting wet and my hair. Across the roof, hearing the roof loud now, I could see Natalie going through the garden among the rain. "Get wet. I hope you catch pneumonia. Go on home, cow face." I jumped hard as I could into the hog wallow, the mud yellowed up to my waist, stinking. I kept on plunging until I fell down and rolled over in it. "Hear them in swimming, sister? I wouldn't mind doing that myself." If I had time. When I have time. I could hear my watch. Mud was warmer than the rain. It smelled awful. She had her back turned. I went around in front of her. You know what I was doing? She turned her back. I went around in front of her, the rain creeping into the mud, flatting her bodice through her dress. It smelled horrible. I was hugging her. That's what I was doing. She turned her back. I went around in front of her. I was hugging her, I tell you. I don't give a damn what you were doing. You don't. You don't. I'll make you. I'll make you give a damn. She hit my hands away. I smeared mud on her with the other hand. I couldn't feel the wet smacking of her hand. I wiped mud from my legs, smeared it on her wet, hard-turning body, hearing her fingers going into my face, but I couldn't feel it even when the rain began to taste sweet on my lips. They saw us from the water first, heads and shoulders. They yelled, and one rose, squatting and sprang among them. They looked like beavers, the water lipping about their chins, yelling, "Take that girl away! What did you want to bring a girl here for? Go on away." "She won't hurt you. We just want to watch you for a while." They squatted in the water. Their heads drew into a clump, watching us. Then they broke and rushed toward us, hurling water with their hands. We moved quick. "Look out, boys. She won't hurt you." "Go on away, Harvard." It was the second boy, the one that thought the horse and wagon back there at the bridge. "Splash them, fellows." "Let's get out and throw them in," another said. "I ain't afraid of any girl." "Splash them, splash them." They rushed toward us, hurling water. We moved back. "Go on away," they yelled. "Go on away." We went away. They huddled just under the bank, their slick heads in a row against the bright water. We went on. That's not for us, is it? The sun slanted through to the moss here and there, leveler. Poor kid, you're just a girl. Little flowers grew among the moss, littler than I had ever seen. You're just a girl, poor kid. There was a path curving along beside the water. Then the water was still again, dark and still and swift. Nothing but a girl, poor sister. We lay in the wet grass, panting, the rain like cold shot on my back. Do you care now? Do you? Do you? My lord, we sure are in a mess. Get up. Where the rain touched my forehead, it began to smart. My hand came red away, streaking off pink in the rain. Does it hurt? Of course it does. What do you reckon? I tried to scratch your eyes out. My lord, we sure do stink. We better try to wash it off in the branch. There's town again, sister. You'll have to go home now. I've got to get back to school. Look how late it's getting. You'll go home now, won't you? But she just looked at me with her black, secret, friendly gaze, the half-naked loaf clutched to her breast. It's wet. I thought we jumped back in time. I took my handkerchief and tried to wipe the loaf, but the crust began to come off, so I stopped. We'll just have to let it dry itself. Hold it like this. She held it like that. It looked kind of like rats had been eating it now. And the water building and building up, the squatting back, the slewed mud, stinking surfaceward, pocking the pattering surface like grease on a hot stove. I told you I'd make you. I don't give a goddamn what you do. Then we heard the running, and we stopped and looked back and saw him coming up the path, running, the level shadows flicking upon his legs. He's in a hurry. Then I saw another man, an oldish man, running heavily, clutching a stick, and the boy, naked from the waist up, clutching his pants as he ran. There's Julio, the little girl said, and then I saw his Italian face and his eyes as he sprang upon me. We went down. His hands were jabbing at my face, and he was saying something and trying to bite me, I reckon. And then they hauled him off and held him heaving and thrashing and yelling, and they held his arms, and he tried to kick me until they dragged him back. The little girl was howling, holding the loaf in both arms. The half-naked boy was darting and jumping up and down, clutching his trousers, and someone pulled me up in time to see another stark-naked figure come around the tranquil bend in the path, running and change direction in mid-stride, and leap into the woods, a couple of garments rigid as boards behind it. Julio still struggled. The man who had pulled me up said, "Whoa now, we got you." He wore a vest but no coat. Upon it was a metal shield. In his other hand he clutched a knotted, polished stick. "Your answer, aren't you?" I said. "I was looking for you. What's the matter?" "I warn you that anything you say will be used against you," he said. "You're under arrest." "I kill him," Julio said. He struggled. Two men held him. The little girl howled steadily, holding the bread. "You steal my sister," Julio said. "Let go, meesters." "Steal his sister?" I said. "Why, I've been—" "Shut up," Ansa said. "You can tell that to Squire." "Steal his sister?" I said. Julio broke from the men and sprang at me again, but the marshal met him and they struggled until the other two pinioned his arms again. Ansa released him, panting. "You darned furriner," he said. "I've a good mind to take you up too for assault and battery." He turned to me again. "Will you come peaceable or do I handcuff you?" "I'll come peaceable," I said. "Anything just so I can find someone, do something with..." "Stole his sister," I said. "Stole his..." "I've warned you," Ansa said. "He aims to charge you with meditated criminal assault. Here, you make that gal shut up that noise." "Oh," I said. Then I began to laugh. Two more boys with plastered heads and round eyes came out of the bushes, buttoning shirts that had already dampened onto their shoulders and arms. And I tried to stop the laughter, but I couldn't. "Watch him, Ansa. He's crazy, I believe." "I'll have to quit," I said. "It'll stop in a minute. The other time it said, ah ha ha," I said, laughing. "Let me sit down a while." I sat down, they watching me, and the little girl with her streaked face and the gnawed-looking loaf, and the water swift and peaceful below the path. After a while the laughter ran out, but my throat wouldn't quit trying to laugh like retching after your stomach is empty. "Whoa now," Ansa said, "get a grip on yourself." "Yes," I said, tightening my throat. There was another yellow butterfly, like one of the sunflecks had come loose. After a while I didn't have to hold my throat so tight. I got up. "I'm ready. Which way?" We followed the path, the two others watching Julio and the little girl and the boys somewhere in the rear. The path went along the river to the bridge. We crossed it and the tracks, people coming to the doors to look at us and more boys materializing from somewhere, until when we turned into the main street we had quite a procession. Before the drugstore stood an auto, a big one, but I didn't recognize them until Mrs. Bland said, "Why, Quentin! Quentin Compson!" Then I saw Gerald and Spode in the back seat, sitting on the back of his neck. And Shreve. I didn't know the two girls. "Quentin Compson," Mrs. Bland said. "Good afternoon," I said, raising my hat. "I'm under arrest. I'm sorry I didn't get your note. Did Shreve tell you?" "Under arrest," Shreve said. "Excuse me," he said. He heaved himself up and climbed over their feet and got out. He had on a pair of my flannel pants, like a glove. I didn't remember forgetting them. I didn't remember how many chins Mrs. Bland had, either. The prettiest girl was with Gerald in front, too. They watched me through veils with a kind of delicate horror. "Who's under arrest?" Shreve said. "What's this, mister?" "Gerald," Mrs. Bland said. "Send these people away. You get in this car, Quentin." Gerald got out. Spode hadn't moved. "What's he done, Cap?" he said. "Robbed a henhouse?" "I warn you," Mansa said. "Do you know the prisoner?" "Know him," Shreve said. "Look here." "Then you can come along to the squire's. You're obstructing justice. Come along." He shook my arm. "Well, good afternoon," I said. "I'm glad to have seen you all. Sorry I couldn't be with you." "You, Gerald," Mrs. Bland said. "Look here, constable," Gerald said. "I warn you, you're interfering with an officer of the law," Ansa said. "If you've anything to say, you can come to the squire's and make cognizance of the prisoner." We went on. Quite a procession now, Ansa and I leading. I could hear them telling them what it was, and Spode asking questions, and then Julio said something violently in Italian, and I looked back and saw the little girl standing at the curb, looking at me with her friendly, inscrutable regard. "Get on home!" Julio shouted at her. "I beat hell out of you!" We went down the street and turned into a bit of lawn in which, set back from the street, stood a one-story building of brick trimmed with white. We went up the rock path to the door, where Ansa halted everyone except us and made them remain outside. We entered, a bare room smelling of stale tobacco. There was a sheet-iron stove in the center of a wooden frame filled with sand, and a faded map on the wall and the dingy plat of a township. Behind a scarred, littered table, a man with a fierce roach of iron-gray hair peered at us over steel spectacles. "Got him, did you, Ansa?" he said. "Got him, squire." He opened a huge dusty book and drew it to him and dipped a foul pen into an inkwell filled with what looked like coal dust. "Look here, mister," Shreve said. "The prisoner's name," the squire said. I told him. He wrote it slowly into the book, the pen scratching with excruciating deliberation. "Look here, mister," Shreve said. "We know this fellow. We—" "Order in the court," Ansa said. "Shut up, bud," Spode said. "Let him do it his way. He's going to anyhow." "Age?" the squire said. I told him. He wrote that, his mouth moving as he wrote. "Occupation?" I told him. "Harvard student, eh?" he said. He looked up at me, bowing his neck a little to see over the spectacles. His eyes were clear and cold, like a goat's. "What are you up to, coming out here kidnapping children?" "They're crazy, squire," Shreve said. "Whoever says this boy's kidnapping—" Julio moved violently. "Crazy," he said. "Don't I catch him, eh? Don't I see with my own eyes?" "You're a liar," Shreve said. "You never—" "Order, order," Ansa said, raising his voice. "You fellas shut up," the squire said. "If they don't stay quiet, turn them out, Ansa." They got quiet. The squire looked at Shreve, then at Spode, then at Gerald. "You know this young man?" he said to Spode. "Yes, Your Honor," Spode said. "He's just a country boy in school up there. He don't mean any harm. I think the marshal'll find it's a mistake. His father's a congregational minister." "Hmm," the squire said. "What was you doing, exactly?" I told him, he watching me with his cold, pale eyes. "How about it, Ansa?" "Might have been," Ansa said. "Them derned furriners." "I American," Julio said. "I got her the paper." "Where's the gal?" He sent her home, Ansa said. Was she scared or anything? Not till Julio there jumped on the prisoner. They were just walking along the river path towards town. Some boys swimming told us which way they went. It's a mistake, Squire, Spode said. Children and dogs are always taking up with him like that. He can't help it. The squire said. He looked out of the window for a while. We watched him. I could hear Julio scratching himself. The squire looked back. Are you satisfied the Galling took any hurt you there? No hurt now, Julio said sullenly. You quit work to hunt for her? Sure I quit. I run like hell. Look a here, look a there. Then man telling me he seen him give her she eat. She go with. The squire said. Well, son, I calculate you owe Julio something for taking him away from his work. Yes, sir, I said. How much? $1, I calculate. I gave Julio $1. Well, Spode said, if that's all, I reckon he's discharged, Your Honor. The squire didn't look at him. How far'd you run him, Ansa? 2 miles, at least. It was about 2 hours before we caught him. The squire said. He mused a while. We watched him, his stiff crest, the spectacles riding low on his nose. The yellow shape of the window grew slowly across the floor, reached the wall, climbing. Dust motes whirled and slanted. $6. $6, Shreve said. What's that for? $6, the squire said. He looked at Shreve a moment, then at me again. Look here, Shreve said. Shut up, Spode said. Give it to him, bud, and let's get out of here. The ladies are waiting for us. You got $6? Yes, I said. I gave him $6. Case dismissed, he said. You get a receipt, Shreve said. You get a signed receipt for that money. The squire looked at Shreve mildly. Case dismissed, he said, without raising his voice. I'll be damned, Shreve said. Come on here, Spode said, taking his arm. Good afternoon, Judge. Much obliged. As we passed out the door, Julio's voice rose again, violent, then ceased. Spode was looking at me, his brown eyes quizzical, a little cold. Well, bud, I reckon you'll do your girl chasing in Boston after this. You damned fool, Shreve said. What the hell do you mean anyway, straggling off here, fooling with these damn wops? Come on, Spode said. They must be getting impatient. Mrs. Bland was talking to them. They were Miss Holmes and Miss Dangerfield, and they quit listening to her and looked at me again with that delicate and curious horror. Their veils turned back upon their little white noses, and their eyes fleeing and mysterious beneath the veils. "Quentin Compson," Mrs. Bland said. "What would your mother say? A young man naturally gets into scrapes, but to be arrested on foot by a country policeman. What did they think he'd done, Gerald?" "Nothing," Gerald said. "Nonsense. What was it you, Spode?" "He was trying to kidnap that little dirty girl, but they caught him in time," Spode said. "Nonsense," Mrs. Bland said, but her voice sort of died away and she stared at me for a moment, and the girls drew their breaths in with a soft, concerted sound. "Fiddlesticks," Mrs. Bland said briskly. "If that isn't just like these ignorant, low-class Yankees. Get in, Quentin." Shreve and I sat on 2 small collapsible seats. Gerald cranked the car and got in, and we started. "Now, Quentin, you tell me what all this foolishness is about," Mrs. Bland said. I told them, Shreve hunched and furious on his little seat, and Spode sitting again on the back of his neck beside Miss Dangerfield. "And the joke is, all the time Quentin had us all fooled," Spode said. "All the time we thought he was the model youth that anybody could trust a daughter with until the police showed him up at his nefarious work." "Hush up, Spode," Mrs. Bland said. We drove down the street and crossed the bridge and past the house where the pink garment hung in the window. "That's what you get for not reading my note. Why didn't you come and get it? Mr. McKenzie says he told you it was there." "Yes, sir, I intended to, but I never went back to the room." "You'd have let us sit there waiting I don't know how long if it hadn't been for Mr. McKenzie." "When he said you hadn't come back, that left an extra place, so we asked him to come." "We're very glad to have you anyway, Mr. McKenzie." Shreve said nothing. His arms were folded, and he glared straight ahead past Gerald's cap. It was a cap for motoring in England. Mrs. Bland said so. We passed that house and three others, and another yard where the little girl stood by the gate. She didn't have the bread now, and her face looked like it had been streaked with coal dust. I waved my hand, but she made no reply, only her head turned slowly as the car passed, following us with her unwinking gaze. Then we ran beside the wall, our shadows running along the wall, and after a while we passed a piece of torn newspaper lying beside the road, and I began to laugh again. I could feel it in my throat, and I looked off into the trees where the afternoon slanted, thinking of afternoon and of the bird and the boys in swimming. But still I couldn't stop it, and then I knew that if I tried too hard to stop it I'd be crying, and I thought about how I'd thought about how I could not be a virgin, with so many of them walking along in the shadows and whispering with their soft girl voices, lingering in the shadowy places, and the words coming out, and perfume, and eyes you could feel not see. But if it was that simple to do, it wouldn't be anything, and if it wasn't anything, what was I? And then Mrs. Bland said, "Quentin, is he sick, Mr. Mackenzie?" And then Shreve's fat hand touched my knee, and Spode began talking, and I quit trying to stop it. "If that hamper is in his way, Mr. Mackenzie, move it over on your side. I brought a hamper of wine because I think young gentlemen should drink wine, although my father, Gerald's grandfather—" "Ever do that? Have you ever done that? In the gray darkness, a little light, her hands locked about?" "They do when they can get it," Spode said. "Hey, Shreve!" Her knees, her face looking at the sky, the smell of honeysuckle upon her face and throat. "Beer, too," Shreve said. His hand touched my knee again. I moved my knee again, like a thin wash of lilac-colored paint, talking about him bringing— "You're not a gentleman," Spode said. "Him between us until the shape of her blurred not with dark." "No, I'm Canadian," Shreve said. Talking about him, the oar-blades winking him along, winking the cap made for motoring in England, and all time rushing beneath, and they two blurred within the other forevermore, he had been in the army, had killed men. "I adore Canada," Miss Dangerfield said. "I think it's marvelous." "Did you ever drink perfume?" Spode said. With one hand he could lift her to his shoulder and run with her, running, running. "No," Shreve said. Running, the beast with two backs, and she blurred in the winking oars, running, the swine of Eubelius, running coupled within how many, Caddy?
"Neither did I," Spode said.
"I don't know too many. There was something terrible in me, terrible in me. Father, I have committed. Have you ever done that? We didn't do that, did we do that?"
"And Gerald's grandfather always picked his own mint before breakfast while the dew was still on it. He wouldn't even let old Wilkie touch it, do you remember, Gerald, but always gathered it himself and made his own julep. He was as crotchety about his julep as an old maid, measuring everything by a recipe in his head. There was only one man he ever gave that recipe to. That was—"
"We did. How can you not know it? If you'll just wait, I'll tell you how it was. It was a crime. We did a terrible crime. It cannot be hid. You think it can, but wait. Poor Quentin, you've never done that, have you? And I'll tell you how it was. I'll tell Father. Then it'll have to be because you love Father. Then we'll have to go away amid the pointing and the horror, the clean flame. I'll make you say we did. I'm stronger than you. I'll make you know we did. You thought it was them, but it was me. Listen, I fooled you all the time. It was me. You thought I was in the house where that damn honeysuckle, trying not to think, the swing, the cedars, the secret surges, the breathing locked, drinking the wild breath, the yes, 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 yes.
Never begot to drink wine himself, but he always said that a hamper—what book did you read that in, the one where Gerald's rowing suit of wine was a necessary part of any gentleman's picnic basket?"
"Did you love them, Caddy? Did you love them? When they touched me, I died." One minute she was standing there, the next he was yelling and pulling at her dress. They went into the hall and up the stairs, yelling and shoving at her up the stairs to the bathroom door, and stopped, her back against the door, and her arm across her face, yelling and trying to shove her into the bathroom when she came into supper. T.P. was feeding him. He started again, just whimpering at first, until she touched him. Then he yelled. She stood there, her eyes like cornered rats. Then I was running in the gray darkness. It smelled of rain and all flower scents, the damp, warm air released, and crickets sawing away in the grass, pacing me with a small traveling island of silence. Fancy watched me across the fence, blotchy like a quilt on a line.
I thought that damn nigger he forgot to feed her again. I ran down the hill in that vacuum of crickets like a breath traveling across a mirror. She was lying in the water, her head on the sandspit, the water flowing about her hips. There was a little more light in the water. Her skirt, half-saturated, flopped along her flanks to the water's motion in heavy ripples, going nowhere, renewed themselves of their own movement. I stood on the bank. I could smell the honeysuckle on the water gap. The air seemed to drizzle with honeysuckle, and with the rasping of crickets, a substance you could feel on the flesh. Is Benji still crying? I don't know, yes, I don't know. Poor Benji. I sat down on the bank. The grass was damp a little, then I found my shoes wet. Get out of that water, are you crazy? But she didn't move. Her face was a white blur, framed out of the blur of the sand by her hair. Get out now. She sat up, then she rose. Her skirt flopped against her, draining. She climbed the bank, her clothes flopping, sat down. Why don't you wring it out? Do you want to catch cold? Yes. The water sucked and gurgled across the sandspit, and on in the dark among the willows, across the shallow, the water rippled like a piece of cloth, holding still a little light as water does. He's crossed all the oceans all around the world. Then she talked about him, clasping her wet knees, her face tilted back in the gray light, the smell of honeysuckle. There was a light in Mother's room and in Benji's where TP was putting him to bed. Do you love him? Her hand came out. I didn't move. It fumbled down my arm, and she held my hand flat against her chest, her heart thudding. No, no. Did he make you? Then he made you do it. Let him. He was stronger than you, and he... Tomorrow I'll kill him. I swear I will. Father needn't know until afterward, and then you and I, nobody need ever know. We can take my school money. We can cancel my matriculation. Caddy, you hate him, don't you? Don't you? She held my hand against her chest, her heart thudding. I turned and caught her arm. Caddy, you hate him, don't you? She moved my hand up against her throat. Her heart was hammering there. Poor Quentin. Her face looked at the sky. It was low, so low that all smells and sounds of night seemed to have been crowded down like under a slack tent, especially the honeysuckle. It had got into my breathing. It was on her face and throat, like paint. Her blood pounded against my hand. I was leaning on my other arm. It began to jerk and jump, and I had to pant to get any air at all out of that thick gray honeysuckle. Yes, I hate him. I would die for him. I've already died for him. I die for him over and over again every time this goes. When I lifted my hand, I could still feel crisscrossed twigs and grass burning into the palm. Poor Quentin. She leaned back on her arms, her hands locked about her knees. You've never done that, have you? What, done what? That, what I have, what I did. Yes, yes, lots of times with lots of girls. Then I was crying. Her hand touched me again, and I was crying against her damp blouse. Then she, lying on her back, looking past my head into the sky. I could see a rim of white under her irises. I opened my knife. Do you remember the day Damity died when you sat down in the water in your drawers? Yes. I held the point of the knife at her throat. It won't take but a second, just a second, then I can do mine. I can do mine, then. All right. Can you do yours by yourself? Yes, the blade's long enough. Benji's in bed by now. Yes. It won't take but a second. I'll try not to hurt. All right. Will you close your eyes? No, like this you'll have to push it harder. Touch your hand to it. But she didn't move. Her eyes were wide open, looking past my head at the sky. Caddy, do you remember how Dilsey fussed at you because your drawers were muddy? Don't cry. I'm not crying, Caddy. Push it. Are you going to? Do you want me to? Yes, push it. Touch your hand to it. Don't cry, poor Quentin. But I couldn't stop. She held my head against her damp, hard breast. I could hear her heart going firm and slow now, not hammering, and the water gurgling among the willows in the dark, and waves of honeysuckle coming up the air. My arm and shoulder were twisted under me. What is it? What are you doing? Her muscles gathered. I sat up. It's my knife. I dropped it. She sat up. What time is it? I don't know. She rose to her feet. I fumbled along the ground. I'm going. Let it go. To the house. I could feel her standing there. I could smell her damp clothes, feeling her there. It's right here somewhere. Let it go. You can find it tomorrow. Come on. Wait a minute. I'll find it. Are you afraid, too? Here it is. It was right here all the time. Was it? Come on.
I got up and followed. We went up the hill, the crickets hushing before us. It's funny how you can sit down and drop something and have to hunt all around for it.